Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
May I say that it's nice to see you, Rosalie. It's been a long time since you've been able to come, and wonderful to see that you're able to come and willing to come.
I'm glad to be back.
So I always feel a great responsibility and a kind of challenge to give a talk to you, to express myself about the Buddha way and about our practice. I kind of take this responsibility very seriously, and I have a lot of experience in Buddhist practice to fall back on or to dredge up or to offer to you, but I've been given a kind of empowerment by my teachers and by my certain initiations that I've had to speak to you about Buddha Dharma. But nevertheless, I still find it, a big responsibility and a big challenge, because even though I have quite a healthy reservoir of practice life and practice periods and sesshins and so forth in my background, in some ways, those... to have experience is one thing. To have experience on your cushion, to have experience in Sangha, to have experience with study of the Dharma is one thing. But in some sense, experience is personal. It's just mine. In a certain way, and so if I try to convey my experience, there's always seems to me some gap, because I can't I can't crawl inside your body and mind, and I can't teach there, I can teach with my words, which I guess, in a sense, come into your ears. So there is some kind of penetration. That's about the best I can do. I can't give you the experience I've had. I can't give that to you exactly. So you have to, everyone has to find their own understanding and their own, have their own unique encounter with practice. And all someone who sits in front of the group can do is, encourage that. Encourage everyone that they meet to have that, authentic encounter with practice. And I was thinking about this today, and the image that came to me was I don't know why this image came to me, but the image that came to me was like a, how a glider works, like a big glider that you can go up in the air with. Well, the way the glider gets up in the air is it has a tow plane, right? A plane has to tow it up into a certain altitude at a certain speed, and only when the glider gets up to the right altitude and I guess with the right speed can the tow plane, you know, release whatever it releases, its tow rope, and only then can the glider, glide. The glider couldn't glide without the tow plane, but the glider can't really do, it can't really be fully a glider until it's gliding, you know. So to me, this is like this is a teacher and student relationship kind of thing, you know, or the leader and the sangha relationship or whatever is, you know, all, you know, there can be an active role on the part of the leader, but ultimately, you know, you have to take the practice in your own, you have to, yeah, fly your own wings. Yeah, you have to soar in your own, right? Yeah. So, recently we had another analogy like this, and we've been studying this book called The Record of the Transmission of the Light. Some of us have been studying it a little bit more intensely in Thursday morning, where we have more time to really go into these cases, and we read these 3 or 4 page stories about different Buddhist ancestors, and so we read the whole case together, and then we talk about anything we don't understand, or try to clarify the difficult patches, or we just marvel at the last one we read. We were marveling at how there was no place to hold on to anywhere in the case. You know, there was, every time he would posit something, he would take it away. Every time he would make a positive statement, he would take the statement away and say the, you know, he had kept doing that over and over again. And it was kind of wonderful. You know, it was like releasing the tow rope, right? He kept releasing it over and over again, you know. But anyway, in that case, which was about the teacher his name is Prajnatara. And Prajnatara was the last ancestor, Buddhist ancestor in our lineage in India. And he was, he had two students, and one of his students was, I guess his student was Bodhidharma. Anyway, Prajnatara's student was Bodhidharma. So Bodhidharma went to China and started Zen after he met Prajnatara. That's the way the story goes. And so anyway, in Prajnatara's story, there was this image that was brought up of a golden needle and a splendid thread. And this was another image of like the teacher-student relationship. And it was, you know, the idea of interdependence of the teacher and the student. So the, you know, teacher is like the needle pulling the thread, but they're completely independent. You can't have any sewing. Neither the needle nor, you know, neither the teacher nor the student can fulfill their function without being hooked, you know, in the eye of the needle. They're completely interdependent and needing each other to complete the function of, well, you know, in the case of the transmission of the light, to complete the function of the transmission of the Dharma from one generation to the next. They have to be joined in the eye of the needle. So that was the image that was used in that case. Do you know the story about Prajnatara? This is an aside, but do you know the story about Prajnatara? It's kind of one of the best ones, I think, in the Book of Serenity. Okay. I didn't think so. But you might remember it once I say.
I thought it was a rhetorical question.
Some of us take him literally. You know?
Okay. So this is a story. This is a story. And what happens is a royal person comes to Prajnatara and says, why don't you read scriptures? Why don't you read, you know, the Buddhist scriptures? And the Prajnatara, who it's actually his backstory is he was a homeless person. Prajnatara was a homeless person. He was apparently a homeless person of high rank, but anyway, he still was homeless. He lost his parents. And he says, this poor wayfarer, like the guy I see, you know, standing with a sign at the end of the freeway, that's like Prajnatara. This poor wayfarer doesn't get involved in doesn't identify with the body and mind. Doesn't identify with the body and mind while breathing in. And doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. This is how I study hundreds of thousands of millions of scrolls. That's Prajnatara's story in the Book of Serenity. So, this is the emphasis on our breath practice, and it's an emphasis on it kind of relates to our chant that we did. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So, speaking of the chant, was written by Koan Ajo, who was Zen Master Dogen's immediate disciple, who Zen Master Dogen gave his approval to at the end of his life, in the middle of the 13th century. And, Ajo really devoted himself really to promoting and kind of consolidating Dogen's teachings. But this particular text, I think maybe, as far as I know, I've never run across anything else written by Ajo himself except this text. And this text that we chanted is just an excerpt from a longer treatise called, it's not that long either, called The Absorption of the Treasury and the Light. And when I was head student at Green Gulch, I had a little book called Minding Mind. It's a little book called Minding Mind by Thomas. It's translations by Thomas Cleary, and I highly recommend this book. I think it's on our, you know, recommended book list on the website. And it's a series of meditation instructions by teachers through, you know, early teachers mostly, both Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. And this text, The Absorption of the Treasury of the Light, the full text can be found in that book, translated by Thomas Cleary. And I commend the full text to you. And this excerpt is quite, you know, as Barry said, what did you say? Amazing. Magnificent. And I've been looking at that text for many years, actually. I've read that over and over again over many years, and it occurred to me that that part of what is being expressed there is in that text let me back up to another point. The other point that I wanted to make is that you know, the teacher-student relationship is really extolled. It's really extolled through much of Zen literature. I mean, the interaction between teachers and students is actually pretty much the whole of Zen literature. I mean, in the koan books and you know, the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Serenity and so forth. So the teacher and student relationship is really almost like the basis of Zen teaching. And I think that we can, as we do our practice, I think we find in ourselves when we're doing our practice, I have this feeling that both teacher and student are present here when we're practicing. In other words, we receive all these teachings, and when we're practicing, when we're sitting our meditation, where these teachings will come up, and when these teachings come up, they're kind of a letter, you know, Zichir Roshi says, a letter from emptiness. There's some active instruction that comes to us when we're sitting, when we hear these teachings, and we receive this kind of, you know, active instruction, but the active instruction is all aimed at helping us let go of any activity, of letting go of all activity, and being, as the text says, you know, without subjective imagery, like a dead person, right? Like a dead person. So all this. There's, so I think that in this text, I hear a kind of interplay between this active aspect of our practice, where we're actually, you know, trying to do something in our cushion, and then, but that we're trying to do is let go of doing. So there's this, I wouldn't call it tension. There's a dynamic. I think there's a dynamic in our practice. There's a dynamic in our practice between the active doing part of our practice and the letting go of doing at all. And we sort of practice on that razor's edge of active, and so you hear in the beginning, of this Ajo's text, I think you hear this kind of active instruction, as if there was something to do on your cushion, and as if there was an agent to do it, as if there was an actual meditator, and it sounds like this. He says, I humbly say to those who are real seekers, who have the same aspiration, do not cling to one device or state. Do not rely on intellectual understanding or brilliance. Do not carry around what you learn by sitting. Plunging body and mind into the great treasury of light without looking back, sit grandly under the eaves, without seeking enlightenment, without trying to get rid of illusion, without aversion to the arising of thoughts, yet without fondly continuing thoughts. If you do not continue thoughts, thoughts cannot arise by themselves. Like an empty space, like a mass of fire, letting your breathing flow out and in, sit decisively, without getting involved in anything at all. Even if 84,000 thoughts, random thoughts, arise and disappear, as long as the individual does not get involved in them, but lets go of them, then each thought will become the light of spiritual power of wisdom. So I think in these lines, When he said sit grandly under the eaves, it reminded me that if you were late to the zendo in the monastery, back in the old days, you had to sit outside. Maybe that's for the people that were late. You had to sit under the eaves. You have to sit outside. They put some zabutons out on the platform, and if you were late to the period, you had to sit outside until the next period started, and then you could come in. But you know, it seems to me in these opening lines, it sounds like there's a trace of effort. There's a trace of somebody being instructed. There's somebody being instructed. It sounds like there's a meditator, and that the meditator is supposed to do something. He's supposed to let go of thoughts. But it's already an effort directed from the side of non-action. It says, in an empty space, or it says, like an empty space, like a mass of fire. In an empty space, in an empty room, nothing is happening. Nothing's going on. And a mass of fire is like this image of, you know, all consuming. There's nothing but the mass of fire. Everything is completely consumed. In the story about, so we're reading this book, Transmission of the Light, and I went back. I went to the end of the book and read the last story, which is a story about our author here, Ajo. And it says in that book that he was a person. Ajo was a person of great determination. He was a person who he followed the monastic rule to the letter, and he was very, very dedicated to his practice, and he did not waver. I'm sure he was a person. It sounds like he was a person who was really into sitting decisively without getting involved in anything at all. He sounds like he was a person like that. But in this text, he realizes and he's conveying that sitting decisively can take you only so far. Sitting with great determination can take you only so far. And that it's with that as the basis, with that as the, you know, the toe plane, ultimately the practice begins, or a certain new chapter in practice begins when that effort, that all of that concentration, that active component of concentration and effort drops away. And then when that drops away, there's only universal activity. There's only a Buddha activity, as Reb was talking about. That's all. That's, you feel that the boundaries of awareness are not limited to this, you know, form. And when kind of experience arises in body and mind, it seems to me that that's the text here is trying to point us at that kind of experience, and is trying to send this message about that kind of spirits, that kind of experience. You know, zazen is just sitting zazen. That's all that's happening. So as he goes on to say, and it is not only sitting. Every step is a walk of light, not engaging in subjective thinking. Step after step, 24 hours a day, you are like someone completely dead, utterly without self-image or subjective thoughts. Nevertheless, outgoing breathing and incoming breathing, the essence of hearing and the essence of feeling, without conscious knowledge or subjective discrimination, are utterly shining light in which body and mind are one suchness. Therefore, when called, there is immediate response. This light in which the ordinary and the sage, the deluded and the enlightened, are one suchness. Even in the midst of activity, it is not hindered by activity. The forests, flowers, the grasses and leaves, people and animals, great and small, long and short, square and round, all appear at once without depending on the discriminations of your thoughts and attention. This is manifest proof that the light is not obstructed by activity. It is empty luminosity, spontaneously shining without exerting mental energy. Especially this part about the forests and the flowers, the grasses and the leaves, and people and animals, great and small, long and short, square and round, all appear at once without depending on the discriminations of your thoughts and attention. There's more there, but that's the line that really struck me just right now when I was reading it. This is the precious Dharma realm, of there. You know, there is activity. Things are appearing. And you let them appear. You let things appear, and you let them appear, and let them appear, and let them appear. And the gift for you is that you're letting them appear without discrimination. Just letting everything come without subjective discrimination. And when you reach that point, when you reach that meditation, you're so grateful, you know, you're so grateful for that, that's a human possibility. I always remember this time, like at Tassajara, when it was after a sesshin, and I was with some fellows, some of my Dharma friends, and there was just a group of guys, and I was just with them, you know, and I was just letting them be who they were. And I don't know, I can't tell you how marvelous it was. I was just letting these people I was with, I was just letting them be who they were, and I was just letting myself be who I was. And it was just completely ordinary and completely amazing, you know? And you know, this is when like all subjective, the subjective judging and the thinking about and evaluating and wondering what your position is versus others and so forth, all of that gone, not there, just with your fellows, you know, your sangha, your friends. And if you have that kind of experience even once in your life, it changes the rest of your whole life. It's unparalleled. And you'll remember it for decades, like I'm remembering it now. I wrote this. Now this meditation is happening without dependence on your thoughts and attention. When you reach this place, There is no you to say I, as Suzuki Roshi says. To express it, the enlightened ones turn to other imagery. There is activity, but it is universal activity. It is just shining spiritual light. In our religious side of the practice, this is called Dharmakaya Buddha, universal Buddha, Buddha in everything, Buddha all, pervading everything. And this is how Ajo expresses it in his final words. This light never has had any place of abode. Even when Buddhas appear in the world, it does not appear in the world. Even when they enter nirvana, it does not enter nirvana. When you are born, the light is not born. When you die, the light is not extinguished. It is not more in Buddhas and not less in sentient beings. It is not lost in confusion nor awakened by enlightenment. It has no location, no appearance, no name. It is the totality of everything, Dharmakaya Buddha. It cannot be grasped, it cannot be rejected, cannot be attained. While unattainable, it is an effect throughout the entire being. From the highest heaven above to the lowest hell below, it is completely clear, a wondrous, inconceivable spiritual light. What causes so much suffering in our lives is our willfulness. Sometimes our willfulness is a very good thing. We can do very good things, and sometimes it's not. But if every aspect of our life is driven by our planning and by our willing and by our scheming and by our activity, it just wears us out. It just wears us out. And so we can really benefit from this Dharma realm where we see ourselves intimately connected. Like a cloud in an endless sky. This is from the, Dukkha ceremony. Like a cloud in an endless sky. Like a lotus in muddy water. Or one with the pure mind of Buddha. This is the transmission of the light, So I think, I think we've been studying this book and we're going to study it some more. We're going to keep studying it until something will happen and we'll go no more, but we're still studying it in the study group. We're going to keep studying it, but we're going to go story after story. We're starting on Bodhidharma this week. We're starting on the first Chinese ancestor, and we're going to keep studying. But I'm taking you tonight. I'm taking you all the way to the transmission of the light, the way to the end. And this is the end. This is Ajo. This is Ajo's expression. This is where this whole idea of the transmission of the light. That's been around for quite a while, but certainly Ajo picks it up and re-expresses it. And Keizan is the author of that book, The Transmission of Light. Well, he certainly knew Ajo and was, practicing with him. And so he probably picked that up from Ajo in naming his text. Although, of course, there are many Chinese texts that are called the lamp records. And so, the idea of a lamp or the light being carried on from generation to generation is an old idea in Buddhism.
How much earlier was the, like that transmission of the land? When was that?
Well, you know, we're reading in the text. We're reading it says that most of the cases are based on the Chinese Jingdi. It says Jingdi lamp record. Yeah. It always says that in the Soto Shu, the Jingdi lamp record, which I assume is, you know, Tang Dynasty or something like that. So, you know, yeah, that's what I say. 800 to 9 something, I would guess. But I don't know for sure. It could be Song Dynasty too. So anyway, sometime before the 13th century, because we know it came, you know, that probably Dogen brought it back from China. So text that we chanted tonight I think it could qualify for the liturgy myself. It's not in the regular Soto Zen liturgy. I've been meaning to ask Mio if he's ever thought about including it in his liturgy. But I think you've heard Mio talk about the subject of the image of light, you know. So I know he's familiar with this kind of treatment, and I've been meaning to send this to him and say, what do you think? Because it is, Barry said, it's a marvelous inspired expression of really authentic practice, life practice experience. Yes, you can take those. Yes, you can take those. They're not in the official liturgy yet, so I was going to say that. Yeah, you can take those with you and look at them. So that's all I have to say. And if you have some comments or questions, we can do that.
Just a comment. It happens not infrequently.
And it happened tonight that something I heard long ago kind of comes at me from the past. So years and years ago, before I sort of became officially a student, long before, I heard Reb talk about stories, people always telling stories or storytelling machines. And if you pay attention to your stories, then they turn to light. And I had no idea what that meant, but it has resonated with me for many years. And tonight, I see even if you have 84,000 stories,
right,
they are a light. So it's like a blast from the past, you know, and a circle being completed somehow.
One thing that struck me just as you were recapping that beautiful chant piece of literature was the cycle of human development that follows that. And Linda and I were having a conversation, I know, Sunday, about the students, the young students at Green Gulch that would be so intense, you know, they'd be sitting all night and working really hard. And it seems like that's part of a cycle of human development. There's that phase of life, you know, a teenager, they're intense, they've got to figure things out, they're really working at it. Yes, they need it. And then I was thinking of my grandmother, who was one of the most serene human beings I've ever encountered. And she had no idea that she was serene. She just was. So I think we don't know when we get there. But somehow we have to go through those phases. So start by sitting hard.
Well, Dogen has that line, you know, yeah. Those who are Buddhas don't necessarily know they're going on being Buddhas, you know.
I don't think any of them know.
Maybe if she was like someone completely dead. Which I find that phrase very interesting.
You have to look at the things that it says right before that, though. Then you understand it. Without subjective...
not engaging in subjective thinking.
Yeah.
Step after step, 24 hours a day. Yeah, so not engaging in subjective thinking.
Utterly without self-image or subjective thoughts.
Yeah.
Backward step after
that. Utterly without self-image or objective thoughts. So this is Sesshin, last period, 9 o'clock. This is Sesshin, last period, 9 o'clock. Or this is Sesshin, 2 o'clock in the morning. And the only way you can do that is to be without self-image or subjective thoughts. Because if you start having subjective thoughts, you can't sit. You can't sit there. You will scream and run out. Mm-hmm. They're squeezed out of you. You have no choice. It's survival. You have to let go. And so you do. And that's the gift, you know, that you do. You finally give up. You give up and you say, I surrender. I surrender.
I can't sit that hard anymore.
I let go of my subjective thoughts about my pain and what I'm doing with the rest of my life and all of that, you know. And then it's not like there's something there then. It's like you're a dead person. That's a good idea to go and die for a while. Yeah. Just go die on your cushion for a while. Mm-hmm. And you know, you'll come back to life. It's fine. You'll be back.
You remember Alexei talking about going to Antaji, and he was in a lot of pain. And didn't the abbot come over to him and said, you're feeling a lot of pain, then just die, I think is what he recounted to him.
Yeah.
It beats the alternative.
I was just thinking about how difficult tonight's talk was for you, Jim. That whatever you had to say wasn't worth saying. I mean, the paradox of moving from value to no value back and forth and trying to figure out your way through the maze to actually say something while not saying anything.
I hope I accomplished that. Do you know this poem? I thought of this today too. I was going to work it in, and since I have 5 minutes, I'll give you this poem if I can remember it. The sound. This has the word his in it. This poem I'm going to explain the poem before I say it. Okay, this poem has the word his in it, and I submit that the his is Dharmakaya Buddha, okay, universal Buddha, all pervading Buddha. So the poem goes, and actually, this poem was the inspiration for the name of this group, Valley Streams Zen Sangha. The sound of the valley streams is his long, broad tongue. The form of the mountains is his pure body. In the night, I heard thousands of sutras being spoken. how can I convey to others what they mean? So, yeah, that's kind of where I started the talk, you know, the difficulty of conveying this, you know, this experience in the night, you know, in the night of our practice, in the night of listening to the valley streams, listening to or observing the form of the mountains. That poem is by Li Po, and he's a famous Chinese poet. Yeah. And the father of Moshan Liren, who was famous woman teacher in China. If I've got that right. Oh, question.
My practice is wait till the last. No, I was just thinking it's an appropriate topic for tonight. I was the moon was transmitting light so incredibly beautifully, and I was just feeling so grateful and awestruck by the, you know, miracle of life on Earth and being here. So, anyway. Thank you.
And it's reflected light.
It's reflected light, yes. Uh-huh.
It's reflected light.
Yeah.